to Shattering Myths, as we do in the second hour of each day's program. We're going to turn our attention to Yah's Torah, in this case, to the second verse of Bereshith. Bereshith is the book known today as Genesis. Bereshith means in the beginning. And we have been talking about the cosmological timeline that was presented by Yahweh in terms of his depiction of the first day of creation. Now recognize this first day of creation is a day from his perspective at creation, and therefore was in the range of about 7.5 billion years from our perspective looking back. And I say that, of course, because time does not flow in the same way, at the same pace, for individuals at different speeds or at different locales. If you're in the presence of great energy, great velocity, great mass, then the time flows much more slowly than it does here on Earth, where we are not in the presence of such great energy, velocity, or mass. And so the perception of time for someone at creation, 24 hours, what would have seemed like 24 hours for them would transpire over 7.5 billion years from our perspective. So with this cosmological reference, we are told that the creator is spirit, which is a radical concept from the idols which were ubiquitous during this time. We are told that God set apart part of himself for a purpose in this disclosure, this eyewitness account of the universe creation. We're told that the Ruach spirit, which is a feminine noun in Hebrew, it's introduced in this statement, and involved in purifying and cleansing, involved in protecting and hovering over God's creation, guiding it, influencing it in positive ways. Now, this is the role that the set-apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh, plays in our lives and those of us who are members of God's covenant family. So, to put all of this into context, the initial statement read, "In the beginning, the Almighty created. He was alongside and closely associated with the spiritual world and the material realm. And the natural physical world existed as a formless, orderless, and empty void, obscured in darkness, along with the presence of the great commotion, the Big Bang, and of an inaccessible and mysterious energy." Can we say a dark energy? To quote the most recent scientific jargon. Now, to that statement, Yahweh added, "The Almighty's Ruach," this would be Elohim Ruach, "the Almighty's Spirit." Ruach is a manifestation of the divine power of God. It's from Ruach, which means that which can be accepted, that which is acceptable, that which can be touched and tangibly experienced, that which is delightful and aids in perception and understanding, that which is enormous and brings relief, revival, renewal, restoration, and the breath of life. Ruach is a feminine noun, and therefore the Almighty's Ruach denotes Yahweh's feminine manifestation, his ability to communicate to us, to serve us, both in a paternal and maternal way. Ruach is the means that Yah uses to nurture us, to give us spiritual birth into his family. So the Almighty's Ruach spirit hovered over, ministered to, and cleansed. This is Rakoff. "Caringly moved rapidly over, quickly served, washed and purified, according to the presence of the waters." Pane is appearance of, and waters is from mayem. Now, before we examine this passage, a word regarding transliteration is once again in order. There is no right or wrong way to alphabetically convey the proper pronunciation of Yahweh. And God's name is Yahweh. How you write it is not particularly important, so long as you know how it is pronounced. The same is true with Ruach and Elohim. There are different ways in the English language to convey these same sounds. So there is not a right or wrong way to present them so long as they are pronounced correctly. And also, you should be aware that names must always be transliterated. That means that you convey their pronunciation. Yahweh is Yahweh in Greek, in English, in Hebrew, in Russian, in German, and in Spanish. God's name does not change depending on the name or the language one is speaking. Names must always be transliterated, while words should always be translated. To transliterate means to convey their proper pronunciation. To translate means to convey their rendering, their meaning.
I find that piece right there, that just that last paragraph there that you read, to be absolutely amazing. Because my mind immediately goes to the names must always be translated.
Yes.
I think of like the placeholders, the placekeepers.
Yes.
I think of those right away, and it's like, wow, that's fantastic.
Yes.
It also goes back to what we've always talked about. You know, if your name is Frank in English, when you go to Iran, your name is going to be Frank. If you go to Israel, your name will be Frank. You know, no matter where you go, your name remains Frank.
Right. Let's just say that your last name is Baker. And you go to live in another country, and they take off from the fact, well, that last name means baker, so he's a chef. So does your last name change to chef or cooker? Because that's a translation of baker, or does your name still remain Baker?
It remains Baker.
Yeah. Oh. You transliterate names. You translate words. Now, with titles, there is the opportunity with titles to do both, which is Masayah is a great example. The title Masayah means the implement doing the work of Yah. And so to say Masayah as to transliterate the title, oh, that's a good thing. But to know what it means, I think, is even better, that it means the implement doing the work of Yah.
And you can say what a name means, like Yahusha is Yah saves.
Yes.
And that's fine, but when you're saying it, you're not saying, every time you say Yahusha, you're not going Yah saves, you know?
No.
You're saying Yahusha.
Yes, it's important to know what the name means if the name has meaning. And Yahusha is a name that conveys extraordinarily important meaning. It says that Yahusha is Yahweh himself saving us. And so that tells us that if your focus is on Yahusha, as Christians are on their Jesus, your focus is in the wrong place. Something that Yahusha told us repetitively is that we ought to have our focus be on the Father, Yahweh. And so all that name means is that Yahweh himself is saving us. So then the meaning of the name is crucial. But getting the name right is the first step of that process. The second step is knowing what the name means. You know, Yahweh has but one name. It is Yahweh. Now, knowing what the name conveys has value, but it's the second step of the process. And if you want to come to know what the name Yahweh means, then you have to do two things. One of the things you do is you search his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. In his Torah, when he introduces himself to Moshe, whom we know as Moses, a name which means to draw out, to draw away from. He's drawing Yah's children away from the political and religious corruption and oppression that is in Egypt. That Yahweh says that his name is based upon the Hebrew verb Hayah, which means to exist. Hayah is also the basis of the Hebrew verb to renew and restore life. And so that is the basis of Yahweh's name. So that's the first thing we come to learn when we study his Torah, is what God's name means. It's the source of existence. It is the means to restored life. Then if we look at actually the letters that comprise his name as the original Hebrew language was conveyed to us using its original alphabet, we find that it's comprised of four letters, two of which are repeated. The first letter is a yod. It's a hand reaching down and out to us, and not a closed hand, but an open hand. It's God reaching out to us to lift us up, just as a loving father would. The second and final letter of Yahweh's name are a hey that was based upon the original Hebrew concept of behold, to pay attention, to look up, to notice. And it is drawn with two people standing on their feet, looking up, not kneeling down, standing on their feet, looking up and reaching up to God, paying attention to him, walking with him, reaching up to grasp his hand. And on between these two individuals, which could be representing Adam and Chawa, the first participants in the covenant in the garden, or Abraham and Sarah, the mother and father of the covenant that is enshrined in the Torah, that or just any two individuals that have chosen to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, they stand on either side of a wall, which is the Hebrew preposition that speaks of an addition, of increasing. And so they say that these individuals are increased. They are added to by God reaching down and lifting us up, us reaching up and paying attention to him. The law was drawn in the form of a tent peg, which denoted the idea of enlarging a home and making it more secure. Speaking again of the purpose of the covenant. So in Yah's name, we have considerable meaning. And so the first challenge is to properly transliterate it, to properly convey its pronunciation as Yahweh, and the second is to understand the meaning of that name, the basis of the name, the purpose of the name. All of these things are important to us. So that you know, the reason when I am writing Ruach, which was made its first appearance in Yah's testimony in this passage, that I write Ruach with a W, is so that you know and come to appreciate the source of the U sound in this word. Just why in the word Elohim, the Almighty, which appeared in this passage, I provide the why so that you know the source of that sound as well. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the opening stanza of the Torah, where Yahweh explains how and when he created the universe. And what we find here is that the book that contains this message to us, Torah, and the verb that Yahweh said in his Torah is the basis of his name, Haya, that just by using those two insights, we come to understand how to properly pronounce Yahweh's name. You see, Haya, the verb, H-A-Y-A-H, transliterated into English, tells you how to pronounce the Yah in Yahweh's name. In Torah, one of the most common words and Hebrew words that has been transliterated into English, the O in Torah comes from the Hebrew wa, the same wa that is in the middle of Yahweh's name. And so if you want instruction, and the Hebrew word Torah means instruction, on how to pronounce Yahweh's name, between Torah and Haya, the verb that it is based upon, and the book that provides us these insights, these instructions, you now know how to pronounce all four of the vowels that comprise God's one and only name, that it is Yahuwah. It's not hard to figure this out. It is interesting to note also that Ruach and Elohim are words. They are not names. They are titles, but titles are common words. Ruach is the Hebrew word for both spirit and for wind. Elohim is the plural of the Hebrew word for mighty one, the Almighty. The only purpose in transliterating them is to convey the sound of the Hebrew words using English characters, and so that when I transliterate Ruach and Elohim, both Hebrew words, and then consistently translate Ruach and Elohim as Spirit and Almighty God, that you know the basis for those translations. Now, this is done so that over time, listeners to this program will come to develop an understanding of the most important Hebrew words. Ruach and Elohim happen to be examples of this. In this regard, there are often several ways that we can go about transliterating them so that you come to know how they are pronounced. Now, they are, however, common words in Hebrew. One of the things that I'm constantly told is that, boy, you shouldn't use the term God as opposed to using the Hebrew Elohim. But we're speaking in English. When we speak in English, I can convey to you the Hebrew basis of it, but that basis does you no good unless I translate it. And simply saying that Elohim is a transliteration of a Hebrew word, it's not translated into English. And the rule is we translate words. And so the closest English word to the concept of Elohim is God. Now, those who would say, but God is based upon Gad and it's based upon Got, both pagan terminologies. Well, that is true. That is how almost every word in English is derived, kind of has a pagan history. But to suggest that Elohim is pure because it has no pagan history would not be true. God himself, Yahweh himself, uses Elohim to describe pagan gods. So the fact that he associates the title Elohim with false gods means that it is no different than us using a translation of it to convey the same concept. God is one of Yahweh's titles. It is not his name. And because it's not his name, it is appropriate to translate. All right, Father happens to be another one of Yahweh's titles. But Upright One, the foundation of the tabernacle, is another of the titles that he uses routinely. It's from the Hebrew Edom. But Elohim is a title based on a common Hebrew word. It is not God's name. God has but one name. That name is Yahweh. Now that we know a little about these Hebrew words that are being presented here in Yah's testimony, let's go back to the meaning of the message that he conveyed. There is a parallel between Bereshith 1:2, that's testimony, and the primary purpose of Yahweh's Spirit. The feminine noun Ruach, Spirit of Elohim, God, Rakoth. That is the verb that was used here in the Genesis account. She washes sin from our souls. She rakoth, purifies and renews mortal humankind by rakoth, covering us with Yahweh's garment of light. She rakoth, hovers over us in a protective way, nurturing and enlightening our minds thereafter. Ruach is the Spirit's title, the title meaning Spirit, and she, her role in our lives, is described by this verb, rakoth. That wasn't a coincidence. It wasn't an accident. Shattering Mist. We're considering the role of the Ruach as Yahweh presented her, this set-apart spirit of God Almighty, whose role in our lives is to purify us, to renew us, to cover us with God's garment of light, to hover over us, protect us, nurture us, enlightening our minds. All of these are attributes of the Ruach Spirit. And as this story unfolds, we're going to discover that the Ruach Spirit highlights by contrast the mortal nature of our nefesh souls. There are so many people are confused over the concept of soul versus spirit. All animals are given souls. souls or consciousness, the thing that God says that makes animals unique from plants. Now, plants he conceived on a previous day. Animals he conceives later. And he says that the unique thing about animals that is not a characteristic of plants is that animals have a nephesh soul. This nephesh soul provides them with consciousness, an ability to observe and react to their environment. That's the difference between plants and animals. So all animals have a soul. Humans have a soul, and that humans are animals. Now, the Ruach spirit is an entirely different thing. The Ruach spirit represents Yahweh's nature. Yahweh is spirit, and Yahweh equates his spirit to light energy. Now, there is a manifestation. There are manifestations of Yahweh's spirit, if you will, or spiritual beings, I should say, is a more accurate concept. Not a manifestation of Yahweh's spirit, but there are spiritual beings that are active in our world. They are under the auspices of Yahweh's control. God created Malak in a command and control regimen, not unlike the way that officers and enlisted would react in a military. While their job has nothing to do with military operations, has nothing to do with controlling anyone, nor warfare, they are created under the auspices of command and control. That's what Shabbat means when God refers to them. And so these spiritual beings do Yah's bidding. They follow his orders and do what he asked them to do. And there is a group of these spiritual beings that rebelled against Yah, Hasatan, the leader of them, his name is Halal ben Shakar, decided that he did not like God's fascination with man that he had created, who he created with free will and choice, and therefore chose to rebel. And so there are spiritual beings now that sided with Hasatan, Halal ben Shakar, and are not only spiritual constructs, but that are in opposition to God. So that it defines the spirit realm. In the spirit realm, you have Yahweh himself, who is spirit and therefore like energy. You have the set-apart spirit, which is part of Yahweh, set apart from him to serve us. The set-apart spirit, being feminine, represents the maternal aspects of God's nature. And then you have these malach, which are spiritual entities created by God for a specific purpose. Their name means that they are messengers, they are envoys, doing the work of spiritual entities. There are two types, those who are still in service to Yahweh, and those who have rebelled against him. So that explains the spiritual realm, if you will. When we are born into Yah's eternal family, we become spiritual beings. Our nephesh soul and Yah's spirit become one, and we become like light, like energy, and we become children of the light, children of God. Now, our nephesh soul, however, is a very different thing. It's mortal. All souls are mortal. Apart from interaction with a spirit, they die.
I was going to ask a question that might take off on a tangent, which I apologize for if it does. But in the end, when he returns, mm-hmm. and people are going to have to basically be responsible for the choices they made, mm-hmm. is he going to make Hasatan also be responsible at that moment in time, or
he will hold him accountable, okay. Not make him responsible. When he returns, everyone who hasn't chosen to engage in the covenant in accordance with its terms and conditions will be instantly destroyed or incarcerated. Those who have misled will be incarcerated. Those who were misled will be, their souls will cease to exist because their souls are mortal. But those who have aligned themselves with Hasatan, their souls will now be considered spiritual in a demonic way, and therefore they cannot be killed. They will be eternally incarcerated and eternally separated from God. God has nothing to do with their punishment. They are not punished in the sense of tormented. There are no fires in hell. It is a lightless place. And so all God is saying is that those souls that led people away from him through religion and politics will be incarcerated, separated from him for all time. Now, what happens when he returns is that Hasatan, whose name is Hallel ben Shakar, Hallel is both conveys arrogance and light. He's an arrogant, false witness who will manifest himself as light. That Hallel ben Shakar and the fallen Malak with him will be locked up. They're going to be locked up for 1,000 years. So they will also be incarcerated in Sheol, in this abyss, in this lightless prison, for 1,000 years. Now, at the end of that 1,000 years, which is the millennial Shabbat on earth, so the millennial Shabbat on earth is going to be very much like the Garden of Eden. We're going to have direct access to Yahweh. We're going to live in his presence. All of the earth is going to be turned into the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden. There's going to be great love, great joy, great merriment. But there will be individuals who are born during the millennial Shabbat. And they, just like Adam and Chawa, are going to have to be given a real choice to choose to reject God if they don't want to spend their eternity with him. And just as in the Garden of Eden, the only way to make a legitimate choice was to have an adversarial influence. Because if God is in your midst and everything is perfect and everything that you're doing is wonderful, you would have, you know, and God is literally with you all the time, and you're enjoying one another's company, there's not much motive to say, I reject you, I don't want to be part of you. You have to have some real choice for free will to be legitimate. So those born during the millennial Shabbat will be exposed to Hasatan, just as he was allowed to slither into the garden and corrupt Yah's testimony to beguile Adam and Chawa. He will be allowed into the millennial Shabbat at its very end, in the last few hours of it, for the express purpose of offering real choice to those who were born during that time. And from that point on, once he beguiles those that he will beguile, whoever number of people that is, then he will be locked up for all eternity along with those who beguiled along with him through religion and politics.
Fantastic.
Okay, that is the answer to your question. Now, it's interesting in the Hebrew that the word ruach also means wind. Wind is something that comes from without, that you can experience yourself, and that nefesh is the Hebrew word for breath, something that comes from within and not from without, that you expel. And your breath ceases when you die. One is always existent, always continues to blow at various places in the world, and is experienced from the outside, and the other is something experienced from the inside that ceases when we die. And so that is the basis of ruach and nefesh. Humans, like all animals, have a nefesh soul. And spiritual beings, Yahweh himself and the set-apart spirit, are spiritual constructs, which means they're akin to energy, where the ruach resides in mortals, in the physical beings. Now, most are aware that consciousness is something which both men and animals share, that we, but most don't know that God specifically said that both men and animals received a soul on the sixth creative day, which means that every animal, from the garden slug to the beloved family dog, has a nefesh soul, including all humans. Shortly thereafter, however, we learn that the ruach of Elohim is distinguished from the nesama che, conscious of life, which is nefah, breathed into Adam, making him more like God and less like all other animals. You see, this nefesh che is the is conscience. It's the very conscience of life versus consciousness. Consciousness is an awareness, the ability to be observant and respond to things like, for example, the Torah teaching. And a conscience is the ability to exercise good judgment. It is the seat of good judgment, of being able to discern that which is right from that which is not. This whole concept of becoming a mortal being with a soul to an eternal being with God's Ruach spirit is made possible by the good judgment we exercise relative to the instructions Yahweh has provided us with in his Torah, which is the book that we are reading now, so that we, with our conscience, discern who to trust. And we discern what God is offering us. We come to understand who he is and what he is providing and respond reasonably and rationally to him. Now, returning to the operative verb of this particular passage, we find that Almighty God, Rakoff, we find him rapidly moving, washing and hovering over, even quickly protecting his infant creation at this phase of the Big Bang, to use his term. And that is consistent with current scientific thought. There was a time in which physical laws were stretched. It occurred early on, during what's called the inflationary period of the cosmos's formation. Physicists claim that most all physical laws were suspended, enabling a great instantaneous expansion. They claim 10 to the 43rd power increase in the size of the universe in 10 to the minus 34 seconds. That they claim that this took place instantly after the Big Bang commenced. This period of Rakoff, of quickly moving and hovering over, was so extreme that two objects an inch apart prior to the inflationary period would be 27 septillion light years separated after it. Not only did the inflationary period commence in creation's first day, its influence on our reality remains at the very heart of all universal explanations. Yah's testimony regarding this is 3,500 years old. Man's realization regarding it is only a few decades old. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To the final segment today of Shattering Myths. We're trying to glean as much understanding as is permissible by observing the testimony that Yahweh provided in his Torah teaching, particularly as it relates now to the spirit of the Almighty God, Rakoff, of quickly moving and hovering over the newly created universe and its consistency with the current scientific explanations. This understanding of what happened is consistent with the primary purpose of Yah's testimony as well, which is to convey why he created the universe and us, not just explaining how he created, but why he created us, illuminating his plan of reconciliation and redemption, of rebirth. To accomplish this, Yahweh's spirit must be shown using water to cleanse and purify, and the Ruach spirit, Mayim water, and Rakoff, instant purification, must follow what preceded it, which was Tohu, lifelessness, Bohu, confusion, and Chosek, darkness, because according to Yahweh's solution, to be saved, we must walk away from man's confusing, dark, and spiritually lifeless world to God's home, a journey which is facilitated and illuminated by the set-apart spirit. So, spirit and purification are well-developed aspects of salvation and of eternal life, but so is water. For example, in Revelation, we find two of many such affirmations. This from Revelation 21, 6 and 7, and then from Revelation 22, 1. I bestow a gift to one who thirsts, longing for what refreshes the soul from the spring of the water of life as a gift freely without cost. He showed me a river of water, being the water of life, crystal clear, coming forth from the throne of God and the Lamb. So in both cases, we find water as the source of life, water as the source of purification. Mayim was used here. Now, Mayim is is interesting in that water is the universal solvent, and that we know from God's testimony that life came forth out of the waters, out of the ocean, and that man himself is comprised mostly of water. And so from this we find many, many affirmations. And the, as is the affirmation of water's essential role in the conception and the nurturing and the preservation of life. That's why scientists search for water on Mars when they're trying to find proof of life. And that water, we know, is the universal solvent. It's why we wash our hands under water. And it's why God made these references to these very concepts. Now, of course, he cheated. He created the universe, and so the metaphor that serves as the source of cleansing, purification, and the source of life, water, he conceived so that it would convey all of these insights to all of us who are willing to observe. Also, you'll notice that in the Revelation presentation, it was our mortal soul that was refreshed by the spring of life. It is our mortality that needs to be refreshed, to be renewed, to be nurtured, and that this refreshing is God's gift that he gives freely without cost. In the book of Hosea, which we have transliterated to be Hosea, Hosea means salvation. The concept of living waters are equated with Yahusha. We read, "The Spirit, the Ruach of Yahweh, will ascend out of the wilderness. His source of life, his basis for purification, and his fountain in joy are all equivalent to his cistern of mercy, his source of blessings, his well of sustenance, and his fountain of life." This from Hosea, Salvation, Hosea 13:15. And so here again we find this connection, and that's how you come to transition from knowing to understanding what is being conveyed in the opening stanzas of this Torah account of our creation. The Spirit of life, the Spirit of God, the Spirit of Yahweh is once again associated, and this time with also with water, but this time with a unique source of the fountain of joy, a unique source of a cistern of mercy. This is the one who ascended out of the wilderness. This is speaking of Yahusha, of the one who, after being tested by in the presence of Hasatan, the adversary, in the wilderness, came out of the wilderness, just as the children of Yisrael did, and crossed through the Jordan River as this source of the flowing of water that was used as a symbol of purification and as a source, a symbol for his blessing and his well of sustenance. Yahweh is now describing the role of his Spirit of water and the relationship to the Son, Yahusha. This has been Shattering Myths.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a